100 years ago, between July and November 1917, the fields of Flanders witnessed one of the bloodiest episodes of the First World War. What took place was officially known as the Third Battle of Ypres, but history recalls the horror as Passchendaele. The chief of the General Staff, Field Marshal Sir Douglas Haig's main aim in initiating the battle was to break through to the coast of Belgium so that the German submarine pens could be destroyed. The Allied assault was launched in the early hours of the 31st of July 1917. Because of the torrential rain, the British and Canadian troops found themselves fighting not only the Germans, but a quagmire of stinking mud that swallowed up men, horses and tanks. After 3 months, 1 week and 3 days of brutal trench warfare, the Allies finally recaptured the village of Passchendaele. But by then, around 250,000 British and Allied soldiers had been killed or wounded in some of the most horrific trench warfare of the conflict. Many of the Hertfordshire men on the fighting front served with the Hertfordshire Regiment. As a pre-war territorial unit, the men of the Harts were part-time soldiers coming from all walks of life.
The Hertfordshire Yeomanry received telegrams at 3 a.m. on the 5th of August, ordering them to report immediately. The Munden troop appeared in their mucking out clothes and little kit, while Second Lieutenant Thurston Holland Hibbert dashed to the Army and Navy stores in London, only to find that they had sold out of revolvers. He found one, however, at the Ironmongers in Watford and a room at the Clarendon Hotel.
The 1st Battalion Hertfordshire Regiment were the only infantry unit from the county to see service overseas, serving on the Western Front from November 1914. But at Passchendaele, the Hertfordshire Regiment's 620 men and officers were virtually wiped out in the first 2 hours of fighting on July the 31st, 1917. They attacked near the village of Saint-Julien, and all the regiment's officers and 75% of the other ranks were either killed, wounded or captured. To mark the centenary, the Hearts at War Community History Project has unveiled a monument to the Hertfordshire Regiment at the battlefield. Hertfordshire's then Lord Lieutenant, Lady Verulam, was there, and so too was Howard Gard, a deputy lieutenant and the author and director of a film called A County at War, which was made in 2014 to mark Hertfordshire's contribution to the First World War effort. And Howard joins me now. So Howard, we'll talk about the film a wee bit later on, but can you just describe for us what the ceremony was like when you arrived in Flanders? Did you go to Saint-Julien itself?
We did. There was a surprisingly large number of people on a battlefield tour. They weren't all from Hertfordshire, but there was a minibus from Sawbridgeworth, quite a few people from Letchworth. And they had really come with the Hearts of War project. It was a field of long grass with two roads dissecting it. And at the junction, there was this very small but pugnacious monument covered in a Union Jack. Not very tall, because unfortunately the Belgian authorities, the planning regulations were such that it had to be not too high. But it was, when unveiled, it was in black marble, and it had an account of very much as you have just read, but it also had a plan of the battlefield area. And we then went on a guided walk around the battlefield. We started where the men had arrived. They moved up to the front at 3:30 in the morning, but they didn't actually get to the front line. They didn't get to no man's land until about 8:30. And there's a river, a very small river, but with very steep banks that they had to cross. And one of their tanks fell in, and the other one had broken down on the way. So they arrived at the battlefield without the support of tanks. They nonetheless pressed on. It was a very shallow hillside. You couldn't really call it a hill, as much of Flanders is very flat, but of course it gave the Germans an incredibly strong vantage point because our men were for the entire time coming uphill. And And the German line, there were no trenches. It was not like the Somme. It was not like what you expect. It was that our men had come from a staging area in the rear. They were protected by artillery, but the Germans were protected by bunkers, and they had a whole series of strong points all the way across the skyline, which were coincidentally protecting a windmill. The windmill was not exactly a military objective, but it was, in fact, the objective of this attack, that our men would take the windmill, which is there still today, and it was grinding corn, and it was particularly moving to think there are photographs of it on its side having been blown up. But like the whole of Belgium, it was rebuilt after the First World War.
There were tanks to help the Hertfordshires in July 1917 at the battle that we now call Passchendaele. But the mud stopped them before they could support the advance on Saint-Julien. It had rained continuously for 2 days and the ground was impassable. In 2 hours, the regiment lost 479 men, killed, wounded, or taken prisoner. They came from every corner of Hertfordshire. The commanding officer, Colonel Frank Page, was from Hertford and died at the start of the advance. All of his young officers also died. The few men left retreated under the command of the regiment's padre. A quartermaster arrived shortly after the battle with supplies and asked a staff officer where he could find the Hertfordshires. After a long pause, the officer replied, "There is no Hertfordshire regiment."
I had, I think, like many people, assumed that I would at least feel where the trenches had been. And of course, they've been totally obliterated. The entire area had been very, very heavily shelled, so it was full of craters. Not as big as you might imagine, but a multitude of them. But we went to a farm museum because they have something called the metal harvest, because the unexploded munitions and bits of tanks and field guns and the whole debris of the war, which is a few feet underground, does actually start to work its way to the surface. And so they're constantly ploughing up mainly unexploded shells, but an enormous variety every year. And we went to see this museum, and they explained that the government granted farmers money to fill all the shell holes in 1918-1919, and that the horses would go round and round and round in circles around a crater, turning the earth into it, because, of course, there were no mechanical diggers, there were no bulldozers, it was just horses and men. And it took them years to get rid of the craters, but, of course, they are now obliterated. So it was difficult to come to terms with the fact that there was nothing tangible there, but certainly you got the sense that if you stripped out all the trees that we were looking at, took out all the endless green, because it's very verdant, and superimposed brown earth and holes and machine gun bullets, you definitely started to feel that it was an absolutely unforgiving slope to walk up if you were under fire. And I think that's what came through, because the casualties were enormously high. And all the time, the windmill was sitting there going round, painted very pretty colours, clearly working very well, and you were left wondering what on earth it had been for, because it was not exactly a military objective. And I think one is used to expecting, or one expects, military objectives to be in some way tangible. And I think that's true of the whole of the Passchendaele, the Ypres front, because it was all for nothing, over nothing, which is very hard to understand rationally.
You spent nearly 3 days on the trip. Did you feel quite immersed in sort of history at the time?
Belgium is steeped in the First World War. I think the first thing you notice are the little Belgian villages, which were all destroyed and were entirely rebuilt exactly as they were. So it's not that you're looking at a museum, but you can't quite understand why these not very fit for purpose houses now, in our current thinking, are looking so pristine and well, because, of course, they rebuilt everything as it was So every town, every village is almost locked in time. There are the inevitable. In Ypres, in the square, there are shops like Tommy's Souvenirs, and obviously now it's actually big business for battlefield tours and tourists in general. But the villages just live with it. They're not exploiting it. It's there. The cemeteries, there are 147 cemeteries, Commonwealth War Graves Commission, in the Passchendaele salient, which is a very small area, and they follow the line of the front line. And they're at every corner, in every field. And the vast majority of them are in fields. Some, very worryingly, are right in the middle of towns, because, of course, the towns were shelled flat and then rebuilt. But the cemeteries are the only abiding thing from the war. Now, that is a very powerful image. And you get them at the bend in rivers, and you get them lots by roads, huge number in fields, and surprisingly small. 100 men, 80 men, some of them really very small, because the dead were buried where they fell. And while the numbers are absolutely astonishing, 500,000 men are estimated to have died, because the Germans also lost a huge number of men. There are only a few colossal graveyards, and they were very much they're called concentration graveyards, because bodies came from a much wider area. But for the most part, they're quite small, but there are an awful lot of them. So it's completely inescapable.
I think one of the battlefield guides who you were talking to during the course of your visit particularly mentioned Hertfordshire, didn't he? And the sort of legacy that the sacrifice Hertfordshire Regiment made.
He works for a company called Battlefield Tours, and he very dramatically, it was not quite Shakespeare, but he very dramatically knelt down and scooped up a handful of rather sandy soil and let it run through his fingers. And he said, "I encourage everybody from Hertfordshire that comes here to do this, because it's got your DNA, because the Hertfordshire Regiment died in this field." And that was a very powerful image.
For you, this must have been following the film that you made in 2014 commemorate the Hertfordshire war effort. To add this at the end of that must have been quite something. Let's turn to the film that you made. I mean, the research was absolutely fascinating, because the film itself doesn't have a lot of moving images, obviously. Mm-hmm. So you gathered from personal archives as well as the county archives. Where did you get the material?
I should explain it. It started with a request from the Queen that every county did something to mark the start of the First World War. And that request went out to the Lord Lieutenants. So Lady Verulam gathered a small group of people, and we discussed initially doing an exhibition. It was going to be at the High Sheriff's Garden Party, so there'd be a lot of talking and a lot of socialising, and there would have been a huge effort to create the exhibition, and there was a real danger that it would not be seen in the best possible circumstances. And if we tried to make a touring exhibition, that was extremely difficult, because they have to be fairly robust, expensive to produce, and also difficult to put on, because they're very demanding of space, and particularly if it was going to go to schools, it was unlikely to go to many. So we settled on making a film, which of course had the huge advantage that the DVD is very cheap to produce. The initial order was for 2,000, and it went to every school in Hertfordshire and all the museums, and people bought copies for a £5 donation. We didn't sell the film, we just asked for a donation to the Army Benevolent Fund. And people organised it in village halls and had little screenings, which was extremely gratifying. I went to a museum in Sawbridgeworth, and they estimated that they had shown it to 2,000 people, which is tremendous exposure. So we embarked on a film, and I assumed that we would end up with a lot of Imperial War Museum footage, and that we would supplement it with photographs from local museums in Hertfordshire. I was always aware that this is a very well-trodden path, and that all the material we would be using is generic. It was really quite difficult to tailor it to Hertfordshire and to make it unique in a way that we had not seen before on television. And I quickly came to question the film footage that we were seeing, because we've seen it all before, and it's also tends to be a bit too jolly and a bit too artificial. We had a small budget, and we hired Dan Hill, who was also involved with the Huts of War project. And Dan did all the initial research for me, mainly from County Archives. And I quickly appreciated that the photographs were really original and very distinctive and told a powerful story, much more so than the film archive. Plus the fact the film archive was very expensive to use because we had to pay royalties and the still photographs weren't.
What you did pull out was the personal photographs of, of families who have lived for generations in Hertfordshire.
We did. A man right at the end came with a photograph of his mother, who was called Winnie, and she was 17 when the photograph was taken in 1917, and she worked in a munitions factory. And that was just magic. Magic for me. He was not well. He was in his 80s. He didn't come to our screening. We never met him. He sent his contribution in through his local museum. But that was just two people that spanned that 100 years, which was, I thought, quite remarkable.
Stand for a moment on our village greens or in our market squares, and you can still hear the voices of the men who did not come home, the men who stayed forever in a foreign land.
When you go home, tell them of us and say, for their tomorrow, we gave our today.